Have you ever wanted to learn a new language, but just didn't have the time or money? I may have a solution for you. Her name is Jessica, and she gives free Chinese lessons daily at 11 p.m. Beijing time and 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Chinese is fun and easy if you have the right teacher. Let Jessica be that teacher and introduce yourself to the fastest growing language in the international job market today at tinyurl.com/tcjessica and tell her Ian sent you.
Do you like fine art but think it might be out of your price range? Do you have a vision for a painting that you'd like to see brought to life but you just don't have the skill? I might have a solution for you. Art by Daisy. With decades of experience, Daisy offers high-quality, affordable watercolor paintings suitable for hanging in your home, office, or even as a gift. With prices starting at just $55, visit tinyurl.com/artbydaisy to find out more.
Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our fourth look at the murders of Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson. Before we get into it, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for The Deathcast, Deathcast Pod, or Deathcast Official. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple ways you can do that. As always, first and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe, and leave a 5-star review. You can also go to buymeacoffee.com/thedeathcast and make a one-time donation. Or you can go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $2.99 a month, you can become a supporter, a backer of this show, like my good friends Channel and Anthony have done. What does being a Patreon member get you? It gets you exclusive access to series such as Columbine and Vince McMahon, but it also gets you early access to ad-free shows, and both of these are at all tiers. So again, that's tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon for $2.99 a month. All right, now that all that is out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back, relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. We left off last week at the end of June 13th, 1994, that's the day that O.J. Simpson returned from Chicago when his ex-wife and Ron Goldman's bodies were found, and he had been interviewed by police, given a vial of blood to them. And at this point, the media circus is really starting to simmer, to boil, and as you're going to see through the progression of this, very early on, there are cracks in the prosecution side of the case, and it's pretty apparent in hindsight that they were woefully unprepared for the firestorm that was about to engulf everyone involved. And what we're about to see happen in this case is something that the media has attempted to recreate with every big case since. However, they have failed miserably. They've tried it with JonBenet Ramsey and Casey Anthony and the Scott Peterson case, on and on ad nauseum. They've never been able to create what happened in this case in terms of public interest and an all-encompassing atmosphere, and that's because this case had everything that the general public craved. You have a beautiful woman, a former sports star, and a slew of characters that were so unique they could have come out of a novel. On top of that, the majority of these characters, whether they admit it or not, relished the opportunity to be in the spotlight that was cast upon them. In today's digital age, the majority of the individuals who the media tries to cast a spotlight on shun that spotlight. I'm talking about specifically the prosecution side as well as the judge. Back during this case, as you're going to see, there was none of that. They embraced it, and it, in my opinion, hampered the case. But you also had other intangibles, things that you couldn't recreate if you tried, moments that became almost iconic in nature, and we're going to be getting to one of those here, hopefully during this episode. On Tuesday, June 14th of 1994, Lang begins his day by turning over the Reebok shoes, which have been inside the cardboard box in his trunk for the rest of the previous evening. While this is going on, Detective Van Adder is completing his report on the two crime scenes as well as on the two murder victims. During the morning, a member of the robbery homicide unit is going to oversee the collection of evidence from O.J. Simpson's white Bronco. And while Lang and Van Adder are assigning various individuals their tasks, they're discussing everything that they know so far when, according to Lang, they were suddenly deluged with a slew of phone calls, not only from the media, but also from high-ranking members within the Los Angeles Police Department who want to know what's going on in this case. They also start to get tips in concerning the crimes, and in their book, Evidence Dismissed, The Untold Story of the People of Los Angeles Against O.J. Simpson, a list of some of the tips that are received that morning is given, and I'm going to read this list verbatim. Quote, Clue 25, person reportedly heard dog bark and saw man run across her front yard. Clue 92, neo-Nazi bikers claim Nicole killed due to interracial marriage. Clue 141, inmate states he was approached to kill the victims. Clue 156, Walter Mezzaluna missing from work, suspect. Clue 170, Mezzaluna is a cocaine distribution point and Goldman is supplying. Clue 174, person reporting confesses to killing victims with bayonet. Clues 177, 181, and 297, Jason Simpson, O.J. Simpson's oldest son, is the suspect. Clue 259 and 317, Cato did it. Clue 262, person reporting saw a neighbor making a machete. Clue 263, Nicole's family did it. Clue 264, psycho heard a voice, OJ didn't do it. Clue 270, informant states the mob committed the murders. Clue 280, informant states Nicole laundering money, mob whacked her. Clue 287, psychic, a serial killer involved. Clue 326, ambulance attendant did it. And the list goes on and on. There are a few, however, in here that we do need to touch on, because they are ones that have continued to haunt the case to this day. The first of these concerns Ron Goldman and the possibility that he was selling cocaine and possibly to Nicole. Now, it is strange that they had the relationship that they did have. Again, it could very possibly be that there was some romance involved in their relationship. And in fact, evidence would seem to suggest that. However, there is no real evidence, either direct or indirect, to indicate that Mezzaluna was operating as a front for a drug ring, or in fact that Ron Goldman was a cocaine dealer. Yes, it's odd that he seemed at times to have a rather lavish lifestyle, and this is something that is going to be picked apart pretty heavily by the defense team, There is no concrete evidence to state that he was a drug dealer. There's also the theory that Jason Simpson, OJ's son, was responsible. This is one of those ideas that first came out at the start of the investigation and has continued to be talked about to this day. There are people out there who believe that O.J. Simpson's son committed this crime. Again, just as with the cocaine accusations about Mezzaluna, there is no concrete evidence anywhere to suggest that Jason Simpson was in fact responsible for these murders. Evidence given for this is the fact that Jason Simpson reportedly was suffering some form of break from reality. He had gone to an emergency room about 6 months beforehand after hearing voices of people who weren't there. There is also evidence stating that he had written in his diaries that he felt like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and would kill anyone who hurt his family. He also had a history of drug and alcohol use and reportedly nearly killed an ex-girlfriend with a knife and also assaulted another friend in what has been called an out-of-control fit of rage, as well as the fact that the watch cap that was found ends up having hairs that do not match OJ, and pictures emerged of his son wearing similar style watch caps. There are other small pieces of evidence that have been thrown out there to support this theory. However, the police have never really considered Jason Simpson a viable suspect for this. Now, we can hypothesize that it's possible Jason Simpson was involved in this in some way, shape, or form, but again, there is no evidence really to support that. And were it the case that Jason Simpson had committed the crimes, it does not explain why his father's blood was found at the crime scene, nor does it explain how his father got a gash on his middle finger that was significant enough to leave blood inside of his own vehicle in the driveway at the Rockingham estate inside of the foyer of his house. But further, if he were responsible for this crime, and this was an extremely brutal crime, you would have to imagine that Jason Simpson would have committed other crimes of a similar nature in the intervening 30 years. But we have nothing stating that he has committed anything like this. And the individual who put forward this theory most strongly has never been able to conclusively prove that his theory is correct. And you do see a lot of these types of theories in these kinds of crimes where people get on to some information and they hear this, they hear that, and they decide, oh, I have the answer, and then they're all over it. They make a couple bucks off the thing and they continue to peddle this theory, you know, until the end of time. And while it's an interesting theory, there's not enough evidence to support it, in my opinion. It's not like the Oklahoma City bombings where the government did some fairly unusual things after the bombing occurred, and multiple people who were involved with McVeigh and can verifiably be involved with McVeigh stated that this isn't exactly what happened, we know what happened, and then those people suddenly suicide themselves in jail. So many other coincidences happening that even people who are considered reputable sources and journalists have questioned the official narrative. In this case, specifically involving Jason Simpson, there's just not enough meat on the bone to bite on. The other one that is interesting, and we're not going to get into it in this episode, is the tip that a serial killer had committed the crimes. Why is that interesting? Because there is a serial killer who has confessed to committing these crimes. This serial killer is currently in prison, obviously, and he has a rather interesting story, but more than having an interesting story, it can be proven that he knew Nicole Brown Simpson and, in fact, worked for her. Back to the case, after speaking with their superiors, both Lang and Van Adder head over to the coroner's office where the official autopsies of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman are scheduled to take place. The autopsies are overseen by Dr. Irwin Golden. Other than the injuries previously discussed, there is a large contusion to the back of Nicole Brown Simpson's skull, which leads those present to conclude that more probably than not, Nicole Brown Simpson suffered some form of blunt force trauma to the back of her head before she was murdered. This would work to the theory that she had been struck, goes down, and then has her throat slit. There are 4 fatal wounds found to Nicole Brown Simpson's body. Obviously, the wound to her neck, which it's discovered during the autopsy, actually went so deep that it nicked her spinal cord. It's learned that there's the possibility of a shoe print on her back, and the coroner postulates that Nicole may have been struck from behind, gone to the ground, and that the killer had then stood on her back, grabbed her hair, pulled her head back, and slit her throat. Dr. Golden also speculates that the killer was right-handed, and that as they were slashing Nicole's throat, they went left to right, which makes sense if the killer is right-handed. He also states that it's his belief that this was a rage killing. During Goldman's autopsy, it's noted that he has large contusions to the back of his skull. There's a large non-fatal wound to his neck. 5 non-fatal puncture wounds are discovered in his cheek. Post-mortem wounds, which indicates to the detectives as well as the coroner that Goldman had been stabbed repeatedly after he died. There are numerous other slashing and stabbing wounds all over Goldman's body. 2 wounds went in through the right side of his chest and perforated the thorax and right lung, while another went in the left side of his abdomen, which cut the abdominal aorta artery. The coroner ends up concluding that it's his belief that the killer used an extremely sharp, single-edged knife that was at least 6 inches in length, and that this same knife was used to kill both victims. After the autopsies, the police really went into, you know, the actual grunt work of their job, trying to piece together who the 2 victims were and what may, in fact, have happened. And the information I'm going to be giving you at this point really is a compilation of facts that were discovered over the subsequent days, weeks, and months. We've already discussed Nicole's background as far as her upbringing and early life, as well as relationship with O.J. Simpson. Information they learned regarding Nicole and Ron is as follows. The 2 had met at roughly a month prior to their slayings at a nearby Starbucks and had become fast friends. Many insisted that neither Goldman or Simpson had a romantic relationship, although it was strongly hinted at that this was a possibility. Now, it's not hard to understand why Nicole Brown Simpson, 35 years old, has just ended a very long-term, brutal relationship. It would make sense that she would want a younger, kinder man, whereas Goldman, who modeled on the side and had aspirations of becoming an actor, who wouldn't want a beautiful blonde woman hanging off of their arm? They further learned that after leaving the Mezzaluna restaurant, Goldman had gone home, where he showered and changed as he had plans to go and have a drink with a bartender by the name of Stuart Tanner, who also worked at Mezzaluna. And this individual was, in fact, the one who had paged Goldman the morning after the murders. Digging deeper into other individuals, they learned that Kato Kaelin had come into the picture somewhere in 1992 while they were both skiing in Aspen. Kaelin ends up moving in with Nicole after she and OJ separated, although there is no indication that this was a romantic relationship in any way, shape, or form. In fact, it appears that both of the Simpsons just happened to find something about Kato endearing, as he would live with Nicole before eventually moving on to OJ's property. Now, initially, Kaelin lived in the back of the property that Nicole was living on, renting one of the bungalows for between $400 and $500 a month, while also helping to take care of Nicole's children on occasion when she needed it. When Nicole purchased the home on South Bundy in January of 1994, the offer was made for Kaelin to rent the spare bedroom in the house. He initially agreed, but changed his mind when OJ offered him a free place to stay at OJ's Rockingham estate. It was later determined that OJ was worried that Kaelin's presence may complicate the attempted reconciliation between Nicole and OJ. According to statements from Kaelin, Simpson had informed him that he intended to go to his daughter Sydney's recital at 5 p.m. After a recital, Simpson returned home and around 9 p.m. asked Kato if he wanted to accompany him to McDonald's, which we've already discussed, Kato paid for. Kato stated that he did not see Simpson again after they returned to the Rockingham estate until about 10:45 p.m., which, as you'll recall, is when Kaelin heard the thumps. He sees the driver at the gate and goes and lets him in. They're talking, and Kato is then told by the driver that he has just made contact with Simpson. And here is a very important fact. Simpson comes out, says that he has overslept, and that he will be a few minutes. Kato and the driver continue to talk. Kato asks the driver if he had felt an earthquake in the last few moments, which the driver says he did not. Simpson then comes out with his luggage as well as his golf clubs, and according to Kato, there was one bag in particular, a half-moon-shaped bag, that Simpson would not allow him to touch. Why is this important? No trace of this bag has ever been found. And it's believed that if Simpson did in fact commit these crimes, the evidence that officially would link him to it, such as the clothing that was worn and the weapon that was used, was inside of this bag. Somewhere between leaving his home in Los Angeles and arriving in Chicago, this bag mysteriously vanishes. And I can remember when all of this was going on, a certain snarling beast of a talking head within the criminal television world repeatedly had a graphic of a plane flying behind her rather bulbous head, trailing a banner that said, "Where's the bag, AC?" And that is because many people believed at the time that A.C. Cowlings may have disposed of this bag. And I want to reiterate, this has never been conclusively proven to be the fact, nor has the existence of this mystery bag, at least to the best of my knowledge, ever been conclusively proven. But that bag did and continues to be a hot button of controversy. Did it exist? If it existed, what happened to it? Or was it simply a mistake on both Cato Kalin's part as well as the part of the driver? After this, the detectives update their supervisors as well as Marcia Clark on the progress they're making. Clark is pushing heavily for the blood evidence. The officers also get a detailed report of all of the items of evidence that have been taken into custody. And one piece of evidence that does not make it into custody is the blood that was on the rear gate leading from the crime scene. If you remember, this was on the underside of the rungs on this gate, and despite the fact that there's photographic evidence of this blood's existence, it was in fact not collected. This is going to have consequences later, because it's believed that that blood may in fact have belonged to the main suspect, O.J. Simpson. Had it been collected, and had it been analyzed and found to belong to O.J. Simpson, there's a better than average chance that he could then have been directly linked to the crime scene. But because this blood evidence was not collected, and because O.J. is going to end up hiring sharks for lawyers, this is something that the defense team is going to be able to exploit quite heavily. The officers also learned that Simpson had supposedly purchased a knife at Ross Cutlery in downtown Los Angeles. After checking in on this, they learned that Simpson had in fact purchased what was called a German-made stiletto folding knife while he was in the process of shooting a movie. And this knife had a 15-inch blade, and it was purchased on May 3rd. Was also learned that at time of purchase, Simpson asked the clerk to sharpen the knife. And the officers end up purchasing a replica of this knife. After all this, the detectives then begin the task of trying to track down the limousine driver, a man by the name of Alan Park. You can see there's a lot of moving parts going on in this case. Detectives are, in fact, sent out to retrace all of Simpson's known steps the previous 2 days, as far as going to the recital, what he did after the recital, and even going to Chicago to search Simpson's room again and retrieve the evidence that the Chicago Police Department has taken into custody for them. One thing that they have the detectives check out while they're out there is a tip that was given to the Chicago Police Department that a man fitting Simpson's description was seen walking into a vacant field behind the O'Hare Plaza Hotel. They also get statements from the other individuals who were on both of OJ's flights to Chicago and his return flight, as they're attempting to find out what his demeanor was during both of these flights. The following day, the detectives work on getting the blood analysis reports. They also have the coroner look at the knife that was purchased to find out if it could in fact be the knife that was used. The coroner states that there's a possibility that given the depth and size of the wounds, that this type of knife may be responsible. Also on this day, we have the first meeting before the LAPD and the district attorney's office. Before this can happen, however, the police learn that Robert Shapiro is now representing O.J. Simpson, as Shapiro comes into the police precinct and informs them of this, basically feeling the detectives out in the process. As for the meeting, Clark immediately wants to know the status of the blood evidence, which is understandable, but at the same time, she has been told repeatedly that they can only push so hard and that the blood evidence results will take time to return. They all discuss the fact that some blood evidence has come back, specifically from one of the gloves, where it's learned that it came from at least two people, and that this blood cannot conclusively rule O.J. Simpson out as the source. They also learn that some of the blood droplets found at the South Bundy crime scene match O.J. Simpson's blood, stating that while the testing is not complete, the blood droplets can be matched to O.J. Simpson with a 93% certainty. After this meeting, the officers learn that Marcia Clark has been doing an end run around the detectives and, in fact, has been calling the SID unit to try and get information on the blood work that is being conducted and on how soon it will be ready. Obviously, this is going to create conflicts between the officers working the case and Marcia Clark, as Marcia Clark is not officially in control of the case at this point. The officers are, and it is not her job, nor is it, in fact, her place to do this type of activity. We can already see, though, that there is stress growing within the prosecution side, mainly due to Marcia Clark's activities. The detectives also learned that Robert Shapiro has formally requested a second autopsy be performed. However, this is not going to be granted. They're, at this point, spinning their wheels trying to figure out what the heck Shapiro's doing. In hindsight, again, it's easy to see what he is doing. He is creating windows of opportunity to poke holes in the prosecution's forthcoming case by stating, we wanted these things and the police would not grant them to us. Therefore, he's going to attempt to paint bias on the part of the police department. In a supplementary note that is added to the case file on that day, June 15th, Lang includes information that was obtained by two other detectives who interviewed the limousine driver, Alan Park. Quote, first responded to Simpson residence to pick up O.J. Simpson. He arrived at 22:25 hours on 6/12/94. Park had been advised to pick up Simpson at 22:45 hours. Consequently, he was 20 minutes early. After his arrival, Park drove up to the Rockingham gate of the Simpson residence. He observed no vehicles parked at the curb. Park then drove the limo northbound on Rockingham to the Ashford gate, where he attempted to contact anyone inside the residence with the gate phone. No one responded. At approximately 22:50 hours, Park observed a male, black, walk up the driveway from the direction of the Rockingham gate at a fast pace and enter the residence at that time. Park attempted to raise someone inside the house. A male voice, he identifies as O.J. Simpson, responded stating, I'm sorry, I overslept. I just got out of the shower. I'll be down in a minute. A short time later, O.J. Simpson emerged from the residence carrying two black nylon duffel bags. Additionally, there was a golf bag on the walkway at the front of the house. Brian Kalin was standing in the front yard. As Simpson exited the residence, Kalin started towards an additional dark-colored bag, which was lying in the driveway closest to the Rockingham gate. Kalin stated he would pick the bag up, however, he was stopped from doing this by Simpson, who retrieved the bag. All three bags, plus the golf bag, were loaded into the limo. Park went on to state that Simpson was sweating profusely and complained of the heat several times while en route to the airport. The air conditioning was on, and Simpson had the rear window down. So this statement right here confirms what Cato Kalin had said, but it also adds two new elements to the growing case. the fact that when Park arrived, there was no vehicle present outside of either gate parked at the curb, and that he observed a black male walking towards the house from the Rockingham Gate, which, as we know, is where the Bronco was found parked later that evening. They also receive a phone call from one of Nicole Brown Simpson's neighbors who gives further information to the police, and here is that notes on that phone call. Quote, on Sunday, 6-12-94, witness was en route to Westward Home Market on San Vicente across from Mezzaluna Restaurant. Witness was eastbound approaching Bun Bay. The light was green for east-west traffic. Witness observed a white Ford Bronco northbound on Bunny run the red light and almost collide with a light gray Nissan two-door who was westbound on San Vicente. The driver of the Nissan was a male, white, 18 to 26, clean-shaven, looked like a college student. Both the Ford Bronco and the Nissan stopped. Witness recognized the driver of the Bronco to be O.J. Simpson. Witness had stopped at the intersection also. Witness observed Simpson lean out of the open driver's door window and yelled at the driver of the Nissan. Witness heard Simpson say, "Get out of the way, move, move, get out of the way." O.J. was angry. The driver of the Nissan got out of the way and continued driving westbound. Simpson drove northbound on Bundy at a high rate of speed. Witness continued to the store. Witness specifically remembers that this all occurred just before 11 p.m. because she saw the westbound Home Market closed at 11 p.m. Witness had to get to the market before it closed. Witness frequents the Brentwood Village area and has seen both O.J. and Nicole in the neighborhood many times. Now we are getting witnesses coming forward with information that is pertinent to the case. However, remember that this case is unlike any in American history. They're getting a lot of witnesses. Many of these witnesses are not going to be able to be used in court because of this growing media firestorm. A number of these witnesses are going to end up going on television shows and basically ruining any credibility they may have within court. Some of them are even going to get paid. And because of this, the prosecution's case is going to be severely hampered. As the week progresses, there is continued friction between the DA's office and the SID team who is doing the blood analysis, with the detectives later stating that they learned Clark was now attempting to get Sid out of it completely and take the blood work from them. This could be a case of Clark being over-anxious to gate the case going before, you know, a judge and a grand jury, but it could also be that her supervisors are putting pressure on her to get this thing moving. Whatever the case is, however, Clark is going to continue with this type of shenanigan and continue to seriously hamper the prosecution at every turn. Again, I'm sure she was a fine lawyer, but this case was well beyond her, and she made numerous missteps throughout it that eventually are going to cost her and the state of California the opportunity to convict O.J. Simpson of the murders. On the 16th, they learn that the glove found at the Simpson estate, if you remember, that's the right-hand glove, had blood which may have belonged to both of the victims as well as to O.J. Simpson. Because of this, Clark informs the detectives that they need to start their day early the next day and get the paperwork going for the arrest warrant for O.J. Simpson. It's at this point in the afternoon of the 16th that the police get a report faxed to them. This report is the one that was made concerning the January 1st, 1989 domestic violence call that Nicole had placed to the Los Angeles Police Department. It reads, quote, I responded to a 911 RC at O.J. Simpson's house, 360 North Rockingham on 1189-0330 hours. Upon arrival, I pushed the electronic gate speaker box button out front. A female answered, housekeeper. She said that everyone was fine and that police were not needed. I told her that I must speak with and see the woman that dialed 911 and I would not leave until I did. About that time, Nicole Simpson came running out of some bushes near the house. She was wearing only a bra and sweat-tight pants, and she had mud down the right leg of the pants. She ran across our driveway to a post containing the gate release button. She collapsed on the post and pushed the button hard several times. She was yelling during this time, he's going to kill me, he's going to kill me. As she said this, the gate opened, and she ran out to me. She grabbed me and hung on to me as she cried nervously and repeated, he's going to kill me. I asked her who was going to kill her. She replied, OJ. I did not know this was OJ Simpson's home, but at this point I felt she might have meant OJ Simpson. I asked her, do you mean OJ Simpson, the football player? She said, yes. I asked her if he had a gun. She said, he's got lots of guns. The question had been for my protection since she had mentioned he was going to kill her. I could see clearly that her face was badly beaten with a cut lip, swollen and blackened left eye and cheek. I also noted a hand imprint on her left neck. When I asked what happened to her face, she replied, OJ had slapped her and kicked her. I saw that she was shaking, so I had my partner, Patricia Miluski, put her uniform jacket on Nicole, then I had her sit in the back of the police vehicle. As she was giving the crime info to my partner, she kept saying, you never do anything about him. You talk to him, then leave. I want him arrested. I want him out so that I can get my kids. She also made the statement that police have come 8 times before for the same thing. I'd only worked WLA for a few months and was unaware of any reports on the Simpsons or radio calls at the home. About this time, O.J. Simpson arrived at the closed gate inside his yard. At first, he did not speak directly to me, but yelled for about 30 seconds towards Nicole seated in the police car. He yelled, I don't want that woman sleeping in my bed anymore. I got two women, and I don't want that woman in my bed anymore. When he slowed down, I told him Nicole wanted him arrested for beating her. He blew up again and yelled that he did not beat her up. He just pushed her out of the bedroom and nothing more. I again told OJ that Nicole wanted him arrested for beating her and that I could clearly see physical evidence on Nicole that confirmed she had been beaten. I then told OJ I was going to have to place him under arrest for beating Nicole. He yelled back, the police have been out here 8 times before and now you're going to arrest me for this? This is a family matter. Why do you want to make a big deal of it? We can handle it. OJ was wearing a bathrobe only, so I told him to go, put some clothes on, then come outside. I told him when my supervisor gets here, I'm going to have to arrest him. OJ went inside. In approximately 2 minutes, the housekeeper came out through the gate and walked directly to the police vehicle. She opened the rear door and started pulling on Nicole and saying, Nicole, don't do this. Come inside now. I pulled the housekeeper back and closed the door. I told her to leave. She was interfering with police investigation and could be arrested. She left. About 3 minutes passed, and OJ peeked over his wall, now dressed. He again complained that I was the only one to come to his house that made a big deal of this. I told him again that I was going to have to arrest him based on Nicole's injuries, and the law required me to arrest him. Sergeant Vinger drove up, and OJ disappeared from the wall. As I explained the situation to Sergeant Vinger, I saw OJ drive out of another driveway in a black Bentley. He sped off southbound, Rockingham, 35 to 45 miles per hour. We were out of our cars at the time and faced in awkward directions. We drove southbound after OJ but never saw him again. We fanned out throughout the nearby streets with 5 units but could not locate him. Red lights and sirens not used during chase due to distance. Nicole was still in our police car and wanted to get back to her kids. She had already signed the criminal report but refused medical treatment or photos of her injuries downtown. During our search for OJ, I had driven down Bundy at Wilshire. I told Nicole we could take quick photos at WLA Division and take her home. She agreed to that. I took 3 photos of Nicole's injuries and had my partner check her for any additional injuries. I then took her home. Within 15 minutes, I got a call from the station that Cole called saying OJ came back. I went back over to 360 Rockingham, but parked three houses up waiting for OJ to drive out again. After approximately 45 minutes, I had the station call her at home. She told the station that OJ had left again before I got there. This is what the police believe is the motive for the murder, at least at this time, that OJ Simpson was so controlling and domineering of his wife that he finally reached a point of, if I can't have her, no one will. That is very possible. As stated, this does appear to be a crime of passion, with the victim suffering wounds that are more than capable of taking her life. Obviously, given the wounds that Nicole suffered, she was the main target of this assault, and Ronald Goldman was simply collateral damage. Now, the officers are going to spend the rest of the day working on paperwork, getting all of their ducks in a row, so to speak, so that the following day, when they meet with Marcia Clark, they can hopefully proceed forward and arrest O.J. Simpson without incident. And one of the things that they decide they're going to try and do the following day is contact Robert Shapiro, inform him that a warrant has been signed for O.J. Simpson's arrest, and see if they cannot get O.J. to voluntarily turn himself in. Part of this is because OJ's a big guy and they're not looking for any form of violence, but there's also the unknown factor of what is OJ going to do should they try to arrest him. Will he become violent towards the cops? Will he harm himself and possibly take his own life? But there's more to it than that. This case is already becoming massive within the media, who are scrutinizing every move made by the police. And the officers know that should there be some dramatic, confrontation where OJ is taken into custody, this is going to further hamper their trial, as the news is already over the place. The people in Los Angeles see this. There's a very good chance that it could further taint their jury pool, and they're not looking to sensationalize this case any more than it already has been. One of the things the detectives did was write up a summary of the events of June 12th, 1994, as the facts presented to them led them to believe things had happened. 2:18 p.m., according to his cellular phone records, O.J. Simpson called Nicole Brown's house, talking to someone, perhaps his daughter, for 3 minutes and 9 seconds. During Langenbanatter's interview with Simpson on June 13th, he seemed to indicate that he had called his wife's home later that night to speak with his daughter. However, there's no toll record of that local call. If this call was made, Simpson probably made it from the telephone inside his home instead of his cellular phone. 4:45 to 5 p.m., Nicole Brown attended her daughter's dance recital at Paul Revere Middle School in Brentwood. Simpson arrived a few minutes late. He brought flowers for his daughter. 6:30 to 6:45 p.m., the recital ended. After the recital, Brown and other family members, including her mother and father and friends, went to dinners at the Mezzaluna restaurant in Brentwood. During Simpson's June 13th interview with Langenbanatter, Simpson claimed that he had been invited to the dinner but declined. In fact, according to other witnesses, he had left the recital upset because he had not been invited to the dinner. As the others go to the restaurant, Simpson left for his home on North Rockingham. 7 p.m., Simpson returned to his home. 7:20, Kaylin asked for and received permission to use Simpson's jacuzzi. Kaylin later indicated that during this conversation, Simpson complained about the provocative clothing his ex-wife and her woman friends wore at his daughter's recital, adding that his relationship with Brown was over. 8:40 p.m., Simpson went to Kaylin's room, claiming that Kaylin had forgotten to turn off the water jets on the jacuzzi. Kaylin insisted that he had. Circa 8:45, Brown, Justin, Sidney, and Sidney's friend left Mezzaluna and went to a Ben & Jerry's ice cream shop across the street from the restaurant. P.M., Brown, her two children, and Sidney's friend arrive at Brown's home at 875 South Bundy Drive. Soon after, the friend's mother picked up her daughter. 9:10 p.m., Simpson, wearing a dark sweatsuit, again went to Kalen's room. This time he asked to borrow $20 to tip the skycap at LAX, claiming he only had large bills. Kalen gave Simpson a $20 bill. 9:15 to 9:30 p.m., Simpson and Kalen went to a McDonald's in Brentwood in Simpson's Bentley using the drive-thru. Kalen paid for the food with another $20 bill. Simpson neither obtained change for the $20 bill Kalen had given him, nor did he ask Kalen for smaller bills from the change he received for the food. 9:30 to 9:45 p.m., Simpson and Kalen returned from McDonald's. Kalen went to his bungalow to eat and did not see Simpson again for nearly 90 minutes. 9:37 p.m., Brown's mother, Judith, called Mezzaluna Restaurant to report that she had lost her eyeglasses. After a brief wait on the phone, the employee, Karen Crawford, informed Judith that she found them outside in the street. 9:40 p.m., Judith Brown reached her daughter to tell her about the glasses. They talked for about 2 minutes. 9:43 p.m., Nicole Brown then called the restaurant and spoke to her friend, Ron Goldman. Goldman offered to drop off the glasses after a shift. Mezzaluna manager John DiBallo told Goldman that he didn't have to make a special trip to Brown's house, but Goldman insisted. 9:50 p.m., Goldman, who had plans to meet a friend later that night, left the restaurant in a red Toyota borrowed from his friend, Andrea Scott, and headed for his apartment to change his clothes. Soon after, Goldman went to Brown's home, parking on the north side of Dorothy Street, facing west near the alley. 10:03 p.m., Simpson tried to reach Paula Barberi on his cellular telephone, but he could not locate her. 10:15 to 10:20, Pablo Fengez, a screenwriter who lives behind Brown's condominium, first heard Brown's Akita's plaintive wail. The dog's name is Cato. 10:25, Alan Park, a limousine driver, arrived 20 minutes earlier at North Rockingham to take Simpson to LAX for his flight to Chicago. He parked at the Ashford Street entrance of Simpson's home. 10:30 to 10:40, Park moved back and forth between the North Rockingham and Ashford Street gates. He did not notice Simpson's white Bronco parked on North Rockingham. 10:35 to 10:40, Park rang Simpson's buzzer. No one answered. He noticed that one light was on upstairs and it was dark downstairs. 10:40 to 10:50, Jill Shively supposedly saw Simpson when he crashed a red light and nearly hit another car at the corner of South Bundy and San Vicente Boulevard. 10:45 to 10:50, Kalen, while on the telephone with his girlfriend, Rachel Ferrara, heard noises on his back wall and wrongly believed that there had been an earthquake. A few minutes later, he went outside with a dim flashlight to investigate. 10:53 to 10:55, Park, who had continued to ring Simpson's brother, called his boss to say that Simpson was not at home. While on the telephone, he saw Kalen at a distance on the other side of the house with a flashlight. 10:53 to 10:55, Park saw a tall person in dark clothing walk across the driveway and quickly enter Simpson's house. The downstairs lights immediately went on. 10:55, Brown's neighbor, screenwriter Steve Schwab, while walking his dog, noticed the white Akita wearing no tags, barking and walking aimlessly. Its paws were bloody, but the dog had no injuries. Schwab took the dog to his own home. He later gave the dog to his neighbors, computer hardware repairman Sakuri Busepta and his wife Bettina Rasmussen. 10:55, 10:56, Park rang the buzzer again. This time Simpson answered. He explained that he had overslept and just stepped out of the shower. In the meantime, Kalen opened the Ashford gate and waved Park into the driveway. 11 to 11:02, Simpson exited his house with four pieces of luggage, a garment bag, a leather travel bag, a half-moon-shaped duffel bag, and his golf clubs. Kalen saw Simpson for the first time since they returned from McDonald's. 10:03 to 10:04, Kalen helped Simpson load the luggage in Park's limousine. Simpson insisted on putting the half-moon-shaped duffel bag in the car himself, refusing to allow Kalen to handle it. Kalen also told Simpson about hearing the three thumps, adding that he was going to look around when he saw the limousine driver. Because Kalen's flashlight didn't work very well, Simpson tried to find him one before leaving. Unable to find it quickly and telling Kalen that he was running late, Simpson left without giving him another flashlight. 11:05 to 11:10, Park, with Simpson in his limo, pull out of the driveway heading for LAX. While stopped momentarily at the North Rockingham gate, he noticed a car parked to the north that he had not seen earlier. 11:20 to 11:25, Simpson called and asked Kalen to set the alarm at his estate. However, Kalen neither had a key to the main house nor did he know how to turn on the burglar alarm. 11:45 to 11:55, noticing how less restless the Akita was, Sakuri, Bozepa, and Bettina Rasmussen took the dog for a walk. 12:10 a.m., the Akita led Bozepa and Rasmussen to Brown's condominium. The dog stopped and looked into the dark walkway. In the moonlight, through all the foliage, they noticed blood trickling down the tile of the walkway on the street side of the gate. At the bottom of the steps, they saw Brown's dead body. The officers believe that Simpson may have been using Cato Kalin as an alibi witness to establish that he was in fact home and had not had anything to do with the murders that occurred, as Kalin stated that the amount of contact he had with Simpson that evening was highly unusual. After filling out this paperwork, they have an individual help them write up the official affidavit for the arrest of O.J. Simpson, which will be gone over with a fine tooth and comb the following day prior to being issued. We are going to end the episode here because next week's episode is all about the day that O.J. is taken into police custody, and this particular day is what really sets the entire media circus on fire. Until next time, the Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing in association with Big Pond Podcasts. Stay morbid!